reaching a point in the session where everybody's going about 9,000 different directions, so things tend to slide a little bit. My apologies for starting late. We're going to open today by opening a works a public hearing on Senate Bill 856. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856 comes to you from Senator Morrison, Representative Shields. Creates a smart and crime task force consisting of 7 members appointed as follows: 2 members appointed by the Senate President from each party, 2 members appointed by the Speaker of the House, 1 from each party, 1 member appointed by the Governor, 4 members appointed by the Attorney General, 1 member appointed by the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Directs the task force to evaluate state funding programs, including child development programs, intended to reduce criminal and delinquent matters, and does other similar things.
Thank you, and we have been honored with an appearance today by our Honorable Speaker of the House, who has another engagement, so I'll invite him up to speak first on this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Jeff Merkley, District 47, and Speaker of the House. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify before you on Senate Bill 856. This bill would establish a Smart on Crime task force. And I come to testify today because 2 years ago I introduced a bill that was quite similar. And so I thought it appropriate to explain to you, while I'm not on this bill, why I think that some of the thinking behind this bill makes a great deal of sense. Specifically, my interest came from wanting to spend the taxpayers' money wisely. That throughout my tenure in the legislature, there's always a tendency to say, let's increase sentences, let's extend sentences, let's do this and that. And we think that that is the best way, perhaps, to enhance public safety, and it might well be. But I thought it would be useful for us to study how the variety of different approaches compare in a cost-benefit way to actually producing public safety, so that through the benefit of having a task force that would bring expertise to the table in a more deliberative environment than the rushed environment that we have here during session, would bring to the table the information of studies from around the country to see how different investments pay off in terms of public safety. And so I won't speak to the exact makeup of the task force, because I really came to express my support for the philosophy of utilizing our time and our efforts to produce the most bang for the buck, if you will. This type of analysis has been taking place in various states around the country, because many states have exactly the same pressures that we have between funding human services, between funding education, between funding different approaches in public safety, and want to get it right in terms of making best possible use of the budget for public safety and its comparison with other budgets. The 2005 Washington legislature directed the Washington State Institute for Public Policy to project whether there are evidence-based options that can reduce the future need for prison beds, and prisons are certainly a major cost driver in our public safety system, or save money for state and local taxpayers and contribute to lower crime rates. In that analysis in Washington, the state found that investing in pre-K education for low-income 3- and 4-year-olds for an investment of $593 per child reduce future costs to taxpayers and victims in public safety by a net of $12,196, or roughly a 20-fold return in the comparative options. Washington State is reviewing evidence-based adult corrections, juvenile corrections, and preventing options, and analyzing the effects of alternative portfolios of these investments. We have increased here in Oregon prison funding by about 25% each biennium for the last 10 years. But meanwhile, we've cut the number of state troopers dramatically. And there is another possibility as to what pays off most in terms of reducing crime. We can have more prisons, but does that mean fewer troopers? And does that, in the end, benefit or harm public safety? We've got their numbers from 444 sworn troops in 1995-97 to 322 in 2005-07. There is a group, the Fight Crime Invest in Kids group of 130, it's a bipartisan group of 137 police chiefs, sheriffs, and district attorneys, whose mission it is to take a hard-nosed look at research on what works and does not work to get kids started on the right track in order to prevent them from going into a life of crime. And they have observed that there is therefore a public safety competition, if you will, between direct spending on prisons and the funding of Head Start, pre-kindergarten, and Oregon Healthy Start. Our district attorney's offices have had flat funding for years. The top prosecutor in most Oregon counties is paid $77,000 annually. Is investment in more pay for prosecutors an important part of the public safety puzzle, and how does that compare to other expenditures? Madam Chair and members of the committee, I could go on in terms of citing the comparisons, but I think you all are very aware, much better than I am, of all the elements that comprise our public safety strategy. And so in the end, this particular Senate bill is about saying, since we need to have a strategy, let's get the best possible information on the table in order to have that strategy be the very best one per taxpayer dollar for the citizens of the state. So thank you very much for the chance to come before you today.
And thank you for coming. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We'll let you scoot out to your other meeting. Okay.
Chair, I would just make one comment that never ceases to surprise me when I hear testimony that Washington State has done this and Washington State has done that. They just seem to be so far out ahead of us on some of these issues. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Okay, Senator Frank Morris, Senator Dave Nelson, and Representative Chip Shields. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. Madam Chair and members, what I'd like to do is to have my colleague, Representative Shields, go through the rationale for the bill, and then I will come back with some additional comments and information that we will share with you. And then Senator Nelson will make his comments as well. So if that meets your pleasure, we will go in that order.
Okay. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative for District 43, North and Northeast Portland. The topic of this hearing cannot be more timely. One need only to look at the Capitol clips this morning as you look at various groups who are concerned about funding for higher education, community colleges, early interventions, et cetera. The co-chair's budget, the one part of the budget that is doing quite well, thank you, is the Department of Corrections, which I oversee in the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Recently in that committee, President Frommeyer was addressing our committee about his concerns about whether or not we have the right mix of public safety dollars, both in prevention, intervention, and other aspects, and also how he feels like the increase in prisons also has a direct effect on the funding of higher education. I just wanted to walk you through exactly what this bill does and some of the rationale around it. It requires a legislative focus, and I think that's important because at the end of the day, the people who are going to have to pass any bill or any budget that has to do with this topic should, in my view, be the ones who will craft it because they know what their caucuses will accept and what their caucuses won't. So you have four legislative members appointed, one from the Attorney General as well, one from the Governor, one from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And if you look at line 15 of the bill, it says, the task force shall evaluate state-funded programs, including but not limited to child development programs that are intended to reduce criminal and delinquent behavior. B, identify state-funded programs that are intended to reduce criminal and delinquent behavior and save costs in the state criminal justice system. C, identify ways in which the state can increase support for state-funded programs that are intended to reduce criminal and delinquent behavior, make recommendations in the state's sentencing guidelines and determinant sentencing that reflect more efficient allocation of public dollars, make recommendations based upon cost-benefit analyses of state criminal justice policies, and make recommendations on how to control criminal justice system costs. And, Madam Chair, I anticipated that the bulk of this work would be done by the Criminal Justice Commission as staff to this this overall task force. You know, I think the question primarily before us is the status quo acceptable at this point? And I think that that it's not. We're going to have another prison that we're going to have to build in 2012, and with the corrections budget growing at a 25% clip and other critical aspects of the public safety system flat, this is an appropriate question for the legislature to ask and for the legislature to answer. And I'll now pass it off to my colleagues or take any questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Shields. Since you walked through the bill, Madam Chair, I have a couple questions on what he just referenced. And the first one would be to Section 1, 2, sub B, when it says identify state-funded programs that are intended to reduce criminal and delinquent behavior and that save costs. So are we limiting ourselves to those programs only that save costs, or are we reviewing all programs that are intended to reduce criminal and delinquent behavior? I think that may be a Scrivener's question in there. But the way I read it, if it doesn't save costs, we're not going to look at it. So whether it actually helps people is clearly a secondary issue. Am I reading that right? Or
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think it's intended to be restrictive on the degree to which we could look at those various programs.
Okay. Follow-up, Madam Chair. I think that's the way it's written, but that's something for lawyers to deal with. My second question was Section 2, sub D, when it says make recommendations for changes in the state sentencing guidelines and determine sentencing that reflect more efficient allocation of public dollars. So are we looking at making sentencing guideline recommendations solely on driven by dollars or by public safety, because that's not even mentioned here?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think that your question is a good one. We've been having some conversations with the District Attorney's Association regarding, you know, making sure that reducing victimization and increasing public safety is somewhere in the language of the bill, and I'm interested in having those conversations. I think probably we should move the bill forward. That would be my recommendation, and I promise to put that type of language in as we get down to Ways and Means.
One more follow-up, Madam Chair.
Please.
I'm not disputing the words of the good representative, but I'm loath to pass bills with the assumption they'll be corrected someplace else.
Don't worry, Senator Cruz. We take our work seriously, and we're not going to be sending out something that's not the way we want it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
Since Senator Cruz started going down this line, I was actually had highlighted the one in between the two that he mentioned. I was looking at 1-2-C, and I was wondering what kind of support you're talking about when you identify ways in which the state can increase support for state-funded programs. Are you looking at political support, monetary support, all of the above? What did you have in mind when you used that language?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that's a very good question. I think that support can come in a variety of different ways, and I think that would be an appropriate topic for the committee to determine whether or not they're talking about moving resources around in the current budget or whether or not there might be some other ways to bring more dollars into the system or whether it's a ballot measure or whatever.
And I guess one final question, Madam Chair. And I, after we talked about this in my office, when you came and brought the bill to my attention, I asked you then if there's anything in the bill that you actually need a bill to do that can't be done now by the Speaker or the Senate President or someone appointing a task force. And I guess you said you would kind of check into that. Have you found anything that's in the bill that you actually need a bill to do?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I think essentially what it comes down to is expressing the will of the legislature that we all buy into the notion that it's time to take a look at these questions. And really, if we can't ask these questions, I think the interim judiciary, the public safety committees, have a difficult time diving into these kinds of depths. So I think just a simple, this is giving legitimacy to the inquiry, I suppose.
Other questions? Thank you. I think the comment about on line 22, where you're talking about the efficient allocation of public dollars, the addition of public safety in that context is a very important one. Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
You're the most senior.
Let's see.
My friend.
Wow.
Oh. We'll follow
protocol.
I appreciate that. I appreciate it. Thank you, Senator. Thank you,
committee. I didn't mean to direct you here. This is, you're in control here. So if you don't like the order, then you change it.
Okay. Thank you and for the opportunity to speak. My name is David Nelson, State Senator. I live in Pelton. I represent four counties in Northeast Oregon. I have two prisons within my Senate district, one in Umatilla and one in Pendleton. And I'm here because during the committee I sit on the Ways and Means portion of public safety, and I asked the question, are we just going to continue to do the same old, same old? So Representative Shields said, well, that sounds like a lead-in here, so how do you feel about this whole situation? And what I'm looking at is we basically have a structural budget gap in the state of Oregon, and I don't think we're addressing that as a body, as a legislative body. How do we address that? One of my concerns in this committee is, if we hire another 140 or how many state patrol we're doing, what's the roll-out cost, not what's the roll-up cost? And I think the speaker touched on that briefly when he said, okay, if you hire these new folks, there's going to be a lot of effects down through the system, and I don't think we're talking about that. So I think we need to look at some particular way of resolving this, and so that's why my interest in this bill. I think the questions you've asked about the details are very crucial and very important. You know, how do you bring all the parties? And I think Crime Victims United probably is not very supportive of this bill at this particular time, but potentially they could be. So how do you include them into the process so that they can help solve this problem? Because, you know, we've got ballot measures that have been passed that basically affect somewhat of the voters well. When I look at this, I think, well, you can either raise taxes to solve this structural budget gap, and the taxes that we have floating around the building now don't even come anywhere near to solving all the problems that we need to be solved. We're talking $2 and $3 billion. You can look at changing programs, which I think this bill is looking at. How do you change this program? Can you actually cut down the cost? The Washington State study that was referenced by the speaker is talking about maybe $2 billion in less cost in building prisons. Very important. But the third thing is, this maybe goes to Senator Walker, is that you can expand the base of economy. And when you talk about Washington doing all these wonderful things, and I'm shameless at doing this, I've got to get water into this conversation somewhere or another. We need to look at developing a broad-based economic development if we want to fund some of these public programs. And water from the Columbia River is going to be one of those. So let's take a combination of two or three things and figure it out.
Madam Chair, I would have been extremely disappointed. I was waiting and waiting and waiting for Senator Nelson to bring up the issue of water.
And I was wondering how he was going to get there from here, and now we know.
Well, Madam Chair, it was Senator Walker that gave me the opening.
I'm happy to do
I wouldn't want to take
that.
Any responsibility.
I miss you on the education sub because it was a regular comment, but... thank you, Senator.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any other questions from the committee? Okay, now Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues. I could continue this shameless...
tax reform?
Well, in talk about tax reform, but we'll get to that. Unfortunately, this is an issue that is oftentimes cast as either tough on crime or soft on crime. Soft on crime doesn't win elections. We recognize that. But what we truly need is a thoughtful look at crime. Look at punishment. Look at the issue of rehabilitation. look at how do we reduce crime. And what this bill really does is focus on the efficient use of scarce dollars to apply them in the best way possible to appropriately address punishment, prevention, and rehabilitation. What I would like to do is refer you to two documents that I have presented to you. Presumably they've been distributed. One is a document that you'll notice by the date. It's 4/14 of 2005. And this is an issue that had plagued my office looking at how we have distributed our dollars and the growth in those dollars. And what you see is a graph that shows the growth adjusted for population and inflation, CPI. It looks at the growth in spending in those broad categories. And what you see is, and broken down further, is you see the general fund has increased approximately 20% over a 15-year period. K through 12 has increased 44%. That's largely a Measure 5 effect. Higher education has decreased 2.8%. Human services 0.1%, and public safety has increased 55%. And when you look at these numbers in greater detail with respect to the information that was provided on this other handout of the Office of Economic Analysis, Department of Administrative Services, and you look at the growth in the population of the state of Oregon and the growth in our prison population, what you see is a projected historically and then projected forward through 2013, you see an average annual growth rate that is in excess of six times the rate of growth of the population of our state. So my good Senator Nelson referenced this structural budget gap. What we have are limited resources, and the gap is growing. And the rate of inflation, you might say crime inflation, of how we deal with this issue is not sustainable. And so I believe it really draws, when you look at the fiscal side, and that's been mostly my experience in this body, is looking at the fiscal side of the issue, it really draws into clear focus the need to think of all the ways that we can not be soft on crime, but more thoughtful in terms of how do we use these dollars so that they're the most efficiently spent. Because the trajectory we are on is not sustainable. And that's the conclusion that I reach, looking at it from a little different perspective. So, Madam Chair, colleagues, I would certainly encourage you to, if necessary, to amend this bill in a way that it makes the most sense and refer it to Ways and Means so that we can move this through the process. Again, to address Senator Byers' issue, there's not a task force created that the chair, president and the speaker can't just do. But this is a really a way of engaging the assembly in this task of looking thoughtfully at crime and how we spend our dollars, and allowing the body to, endorse this in a very public way, because it is a hot topic. It is something that is going to draw a lot of attention. But we need to have that attention brought to it. And we do need more thoughtful responses. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and colleagues. I appreciate the comments because you're right, Senator Morris. You're either tough on crime or soft on crime, and we can't get anything passed in this legislature because people are living in fear. They're afraid to act either way. And, you know, I wouldn't be so upset about the increase in public spending if we saw something, public spending for public safety, if we saw something for our money other than incarcerating more people in prisons. There's not, in my mind, a lot that's been spent on prevention. There's not a lot that has reduced the rate of recidivism. We're just more intent on building more facilities, and I've got one scheduled for my community in Junction City, and I hope it doesn't get built because it is a lot of money. And I guess, you know, I've got to build this session that looks at all the tax breaks that we give away and asks for accountability in the system. And what I like about this bill is it's asking us to look at our public safety system. Are we getting what we pay for, and what's coming out of the system? And, you know, on one hand, do we have the balance of the scales where we're protecting the public, and on the other, are we trying to reduce the number of criminals that go into our system by preventing the crime in the first place? So I appreciate it, and, you know, you can wordsmith this some if you can, but I don't think it's at all unreasonable to ask us to stop and look at this public safety system and the expenditures that are just spiraling out of control. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
That's my question.
Well, and I want to compliment all three of you for really framing this as a fiscal issue, because I don't think there's any argument that we all agree we need to protect public safety. But there are more than one way to protect public safety, and we need to figure out the most efficient way to do that. We really struggled with that with the meth package last session. You know, the question was, do we take, you know, 10 of the worst offenders and send them to prison for 30 years, or do we use the money at the front end in drug courts and other methods to try to prevent the issue from becoming an issue in the first place?
Madam Chair, can I leave you with one last allegory or literary thing?
Please do. It doesn't have to do about the Columbia River.
Oh, does it? This is the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, and it goes, water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor not a drop to drink. So think of the picture of that. I mean, we've got shrinking boards. We've got all this stuff out here available to us. We don't have any of it to drink, and it's hurting our whole system. And so I think the structural budget gap should be our number one priority, what we're doing in this legislative session.
Madam Chair, I'm confused now because I thought it was nor any a drop to drink.
Nor any drop to drink, yeah.
Yes.
Water, water everywhere.
We can amend that.
And all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere. And all the boards did shrink because he's on
that
a boat.
That part you had right. It's later on where you got confused.
We're all amateur scriveners here, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Joshua Marquis and Steve Dole.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Josh Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County. I'm also a member of the Criminal Justice Commission, although I'm not speaking on their behalf today, although I think other members of the Criminal Justice Commission. I am here representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a little intimidated after that rather august group of people, as well as yourselves, talking about the need for a group to study these issues. And I don't think there's any question but that those are laudable goals. I would suggest to you that you have an organization which I attend regularly, and I think Senator Burdick sits on, the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, that does just that and has legislative members, and every member of the Criminal Justice Commission has to be approved by your body, the Senate. But language does matter, and I'm sorry, but, you know, if this is smart on crime, does that mean I'm part of the dumb on crime group? I don't think it's a guns or butter issue. And to respond to Senator Walker's comment about what have we gotten for some of the prison building, we've reduced the violent crime rate more in Oregon than any state in the country. As a prosecutor, I don't get frequent flyer miles for the people I put in prison. And in fact, the common belief is that people go to prison for most crimes. 84% of Oregon felons don't go to prison. And there is a need. I'm a member of the group Fight Crimes, Invest in Kids. These are all very important things. But if you're going to have a group like this, I would suggest, at a minimum, you look at maybe restructuring the participation in it. You need practitioners. And I'm not just speaking about prosecutors. I'm talking about criminal defense lawyers, people who, like me, are in court every single day dealing with these issues. And I suggest that you need to, as I think Senator Cruz brought up the issue, if you're going to have this task force, it needs to have a broader focus and not just ways in which we can save money. Because otherwise, I mean, we're using just buzzwords, and that would be no more fair than if I were to propose to you a truth in sentencing commission. And I think we all know what that's code words for. And I don't think we should be speaking in code words. I think these are legitimate issues, and I think the Oregon DA's Association could get on board a lot of the subject matter of this, but I think it needs to be rearranged and reworded significantly. Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. Steve.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole. I'm president of the Crime Victims United of Oregon, and I don't oppose the concept of this bill, but I do oppose the way the bill is presently constituted. I'm not going to be try to be too repetitive here. You know, if I had a wish list, one of my wish lists would be that I could take this presentation that you have in your hands and go to the Senate Democrats, the Senate Republicans, and the same in the House, and with a PowerPoint presentation give you 1 hour so you'd really understand what Measure 11 is all about. That first page represents, if you go from 1960, I don't know where all of you were in 1960, I was a fourth grader in St. Cecilia grade school out in North Portland. That's what our crime rate looked like. Between 1960 and 1985, we saw a 700% increase in the rate of crime, violent crime, in the state of Oregon. And if you turn the page sideways, you'll see what the legislature did about that violent crime rate increase. They built one new prison with 400 beds. Now, I wouldn't call that dumb on crime or smart on crime or anything else, because I think those are very churlish and pejorative words to be using, and I think we're all adults here. I'll tell you what I would call it, though. I would call it irresponsible on crime, because that's what we did. Somewhere we finally had to pay the credit card off, and so we started building prisons in the early 90s. With the sentencing guidelines reform, and then along came Measure 11, and you can see what the drop-off, and as Mr. Marquis said, if you look on page 5 of this handout, you'll see that we had the highest percentage decrease in the violent crime rate in the United States. While the rest of the states went down 28%, we went down 44%, and currently we were number 2 for the last couple of years, we're currently number 3. I would tell you that on the second page you'll see the Measure 11 sentences, and you know what? We've always been open to modifying Measure 11 in reasonable terms, because every place you see a gray line is where we've modified Measure 11 with the help of this legislature, and I'll tell you who sponsored those modifications. It was Crime Victims United and law enforcement. That's the DAs, the sheriffs, and the chiefs of police. So we're not obstructionists. Last thing I'll say before I get off of it is this. I think we got to talk in real terms about money issues. And, you know, I'm sensitive to that. I'm a taxpayer. But let's talk about all funds. You know, when you look at the all funds budget, you'll find that the two lowest ends of in the history of all fund appropriations in public safety as a percentage are the Department of Corrections at 26.8% from 1995 through 2009, and the District Attorney's at 14.7%. I'm sorry, Senator, that's not in your handout. But at the very end of your handout, you will find this, and I'll end with this, that if you look at all funds budgeting, President Frohnmayer was in here, and I respect Mr. President Frohnmayer, but he made this, as Josh referred to, guns or butter argument. You know, back in the 30s they made that, and we found out we had to feed our people and go to war. We got to do both. I didn't get to send a daughter to college because we weren't protecting her at a given point in time. And we will spend in all funds budget this year $3.9 billion when you take away tuition, because I don't think you can count that. That's money out of people's pockets on top of taxes. $3.9 billion on higher education, and we'll spend about $1.13 billion to lock people up. That's without community corrections. So I'd like to have realistic discussions about these issues, and I agree with Josh. I think you need a defense attorney. I think you need a prosecutor on this. And last but not least, I think you need to include this language. because the only way we really measure where we're going when it comes to crime is we got to look at the crime rates. And if you don't think that locking people up works, look at that red line and where it went after Measure 11 was passed, and then study page 4 with the violent crime rate for the United States and the state of Oregon. But when it comes to property crime, I can tell you it's a different story, because we're number 4 in the country, according to the FBI, on property crime. So in summation, I think we have to put language in this bill that talks about reducing the crime rate, about reducing recidivism, and about reducing victimization. Those three things, and those should be your big three. And I really appreciate the time you've given me to express these, and I hope we go forward with this. I hope we can make the changes and change the name of the bill and get on with the discussion. Thanks very much.
Well, I'm glad to hear that both of you are willing to have a discussion. I'm one of those who agree that this issue has become way too polarized, and I'm certainly not going to argue with the premise that someone who is incarcerated in a maximum security facility is not going to commit a crime. I mean, I think common sense would tell you that. The question is, that's the highest cost method of preventing somebody from committing a crime. And so if there are ways that you can get there in a cheaper way, I think that's what people are talking about. I know I, for one, am not talking about throwing people out in the streets to victimize people. And, you know, one of the things I would hope is if we can get smarter about some of these things and do it more cost efficiently, then we will have more money to put in the system where it's needed for indigent defense, for DAs, for drug treatment, the things that are really proven to have a benefit in terms of reducing recidivism. Because it's really, if there was one measure of what is going to get us out of this increase in the crime rate, it's reducing the recidivism. And if there are ways we can do that, and, you know, picking out the people that we can make a difference with, and then there are other people who need to go be locked up for a very, very long time that will never be safe to roam the streets. So it's I'm glad to hear that you're willing to have this conversation, because I think it's a conversation all of us need to be having in this society. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dana Heppert.
Hi. Thank you so much for the time to testify. My name is Dana Hepper. I'm the statewide advocacy coordinator with Stand for Children. And just 2 weeks ago, Stand for Children leaders from across the state unanimously agreed to support smart criminal justice reforms that are good for kids and families and good for the future of Oregon. And Senate Bill 856 is one of those. You all know the stunning facts and figures. In the past 10 years, Oregon has had the third fastest growing prison system in the country. And also during the past 10 years, you all are familiar that we're spending $1,800 less per student when adjusted for inflation and student population growth. So it's pretty staggering. We've actually had the fastest sliding education budget other than Florida. We've built 5 prisons and expanded 4 in that time period. We've seen the Department of Corrections budget triple in the past 12 years. And you all know that each time Oregon builds a prison, it borrows money to pay for construction. In this biennium 2007-2009, we'll spend $130 million just on debt service for past prison construction. It's a pretty staggering amount of money. We won't be building any new prisons this biennium, but the Department of Corrections has indicated that they're 2 years away from needing an additional prison at a cost of over $600 million. It's a huge amount of money, and it just speaks to why Senate Bill 856 is so timely right now, that we can actually be one step ahead of the game. Stand for Children members really liked the Smart on Crime Task Force proposal, because it addresses problems in the same way our members like to address problems, which is to form a task force to research the problems and present some viable solutions for addressing the problem, and then bring community members and elected officials together to implement those solutions. We found this to be a really effective approach when talking about public schools, talking about tax reform, et cetera, and we're excited to take this approach to talk about public safety. I won't repeat what you heard from Speaker Merkley about the state of Washington and their approach to this similar problem, but it's just great to know that we can benefit and learn from the research and best practices already being done by other states. And that's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you. That's all we have signed up. Is there anybody else who wanted to speak on this? Mr. Prinz is in the back of the room, having not signed up.
Madam Chair, thank you. For the record, Craig Prinz. I didn't get a chance to sign up. I came in the back. I wanted to relay the thoughts of the some of the Criminal Justice Commission members who've talked about this bill. They don't oppose it. They didn't take a vote on it for or against. They just had a couple of thoughts. One, they wanted to make I basically looked at all the emails and tried to boil it down to three things. They wanted to avoid duplication of having the Criminal Justice Commission and the Smart on Crime Task Force doing the same thing. I think it's clear that the Smart on Crime Task Force is for a set amount of time and would go away. So they just wanted to have a discussion about how that would work so we wouldn't be duplicating our efforts. In that vein, I wanted to let the committee know I the Washington State model is one that I've directed my staff to work with. Senator Burdick, you know that. You know that we've basically followed the model that Steve Ose has started in Washington and would want to continue to do that. And that is in our report to the legislature for 2007. We did the first part of that, which is looking at the estimated benefit of incarceration. And then the next step would be following the next part of that, which is basically that portfolio that one of the speakers mentioned on looking at avoiding future costs with investments in prevention and treatment and things like that. So I want to let you know that a lot of the work here, I'm pleased to say we're already working in this vein. The other thing was, so they wanted to avoid duplication. The commission members just wanted to understand how would the Criminal Justice Commission and the Smart on Crime Task Force interact? What would be the interaction? And then the third part was the allocation of resources issue, which I think I'm keenly interested as the executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission, and I think that my commissioners were too, but what resources would there be to do the Smart on Crime work if it was to pass, and how would I coordinate with that if it's going to be a legislative appropriation? So I just want to make those comments, and I'm sorry that I didn't sign up, and I can try to answer any other questions if you have any.
You'll be fined at the end of the hearing, Mr. Prinz. Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Prinz, Mr. Marquis testified, and I had to look back through my notes. He did indicate he was here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, though I do know he serves on the commission. So would you verify for me that he was not here representing the commission?
That's, Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct. The commission did not want to take a vote for or against it.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 856 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 985. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 985 comes to you from sponsored by Senator Bates, and it prohibits a petitioner in a post-conviction relief proceeding to compel the victim to testify by either by deposition or hearing unless a court allows the petition to do so. Requires the court to allow petition to compel the victim to testify if the petitioner can demonstrate good cause by showing that the victim has information that is material to post-conviction relief proceedings, is favorable to the petitioner, and is other than what is admitted at trial, allows the victim to appear by telephone by with court permission. And, Chairman of the Committee, what makes post-conviction relief unique in the sense it is an appeal, not an appeal, it's after the appellate process has ended of a criminal matter, but it's a civil matter. treat it as a civil matter, and as such, you have the right to depose and witnesses and subpoena witnesses.
Okay. Thank you. I don't see Senator Bates here. Anybody from his office? Okay. We will start out with Attorney General Hardy Myers, and it looks like you wanted to testify with Mr. Dole on this. Okay. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony in support of Senate Bill 985. By way of context, the Department of Justice represents the state in all challenges to criminal convictions, including direct appeals, state post-conviction, and federal habeas corpus. And in the state post-conviction proceedings, the convicted offender, after the conviction has been affirmed on direct appeal, can attack his or her conviction by alleging grounds for relief that were not or could not be raised on direct appeal. For example, that the offender did not receive effective assistance of counsel on the appeal. And a post-conviction case first involves a proceeding in circuit court which creates a record on which the circuit judge will determine whether the petitioner has established a basis for relief. And that is also the record that would be reviewed on post-conviction appeal. Now, under current law, attorneys for the post-conviction petitioner can compel a victim by subpoena to undergo examination by deposition or at post-conviction hearing without any showing of need to subject the victim to that process, without any showing that the victim is likely to provide any new evidence that will benefit the petitioner. And because a post-conviction proceeding is not a retrial of guilt or innocence, it's rarely useful for a petitioner to compel a victim to testify in that proceeding, whether by deposition or at hearing. And current procedure can also require the victim to physically confront the convicted offender at deposition or hearing. Now, the trial court phase of a post-conviction proceeding can occur years after the original trial and conviction. And the forced involvement of the victim with the post-conviction process compels the victim to reconfront the crime and to relive the victim's trauma. And under current law, the only means victims have to avoid being subjected to questioning, to examination in the post-conviction process is to file a motion to quash the subpoena issued by the offender's attorney. The court may use its discretion to decide that motion. There are currently no statutory provisions providing courts with a standard to follow when considering whether to grant the motion to quash. So the measure, Senate Bill 985, would make some basic and appropriate changes in Oregon law to protect victims against being unnecessarily re-victimized, re-traumatized in the post-conviction process. The measure prohibits a post-conviction petitioner from compelling a victim to testify by deposition or otherwise without a court-ordered subpoena. The measure prohibits a court approving an order for a subpoena unless the petitioner can show that the victim has information material to the proceeding, favorable to the victim, and that has not already been admitted in the prior trial. And the measure also authorizes the court to allow the victim, upon the victim's request, to appear by telephone or other communication device approved by the court to avoid personal contact between the victim and the offender. Madam Chair and members, as you will be hearing momentarily from other witnesses, and as I think we all understand, it can be an extremely emotional experience for a crime victim to be forced by the criminal justice system to relive the offense. Now, sometimes that trauma will be unavoidable, but the justice system should not impose that trauma unnecessarily.
In other words, I think our goal ought to be to have a justice system in which we have scrupulous respect for the constitutional rights of the accused, while at the same time the system operates in as victim-sensitive a way as is possible. And I think this measure would be an important step in achieving that goal. And I sincerely hope the committee will give Senate Bill 985 its strong support.
Thank you. Do you think it'd be fair to say that in a case where a victim's testimony was necessary to ensure that the accused had their full rights, that in those cases the victim would be provided?
Madam Chair, yes. And we think that the standards set out in the measure for a good cause showing to compel the witness to be subjected to examination is a good workable standard for determining those situations in which it's really appropriate to make the victim go through that experience.
And an example, to use an example, in a case of abuse, this would protect the victim from a continuation of the abuse that maybe led to the conviction.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And Madam Chair, I see that it allows communication by telephone or other device so the victim doesn't have to appear in court if they are ordered to appear, which normally I don't like that sort of thing in testimony because you can't see the witness, but in this case, this person has already been proven to be a victim and shouldn't have to go through that again. And is that why the sensitivity is there, Mr. Attorney General?
Pardon me?
To allow someone to appear by telephone, that's being sensitive to the nature of being a victim and not wanting to have to appear again.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, yes. And it's really designed to get at the aspect of the current process that can force the victim physically to actually physically confront the accuser, or the offender, rather.
But this doesn't require them to appear by telephone. It just has that option for the court.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. The court may grant an order allowing such alternative means of being examined if the court approves that. But it's not compulsory upon the victim's motion.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, from the council. Attorney General Hardy Myers, what do you mean by victim? Who would make the determination?
Chair Burdick, Mr. Taylor, there is a definition of victim in I think actually more than one place within the Oregon Code. I would suppose that if there is an issue about that, it would have to be resolved judicially.
Thanks.
Okay, that's good to get that on the record. Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Dole.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United of Oregon. I'm going to make my testimony very short. I thank you for giving a hearing to this bill this afternoon, and I thank the Attorney General for joining us as a requester on the bill and for Senator Bates' sponsorship and all others who signed on to this bill. Because the General Myers gave such a great and eloquent presentation of what the bill does, I really don't have much to add to that, so it is actually my honor this afternoon to introduce to you members of our organization who drove up from Ashland, Oregon today, Mr. and Mrs. Phil Lindsay, Phil and Shelley Lindsay, and they have their children here with them who they will introduce to you, and also they are going to bring up one of their children, Simon, who will give testimony. So with that, I'd just like to cede my time and so we could hear because this story dramatizes the situation we've been placed in as victims, and that is that over the last number of years, I've got increasing numbers of calls from victims who have been placed into this position of having to be subpoenaed and then brought into court by people who have been convicted of crimes, and as General Myers said, this is a re-victimization for these people. So with that, I thank you very much, and I will turn it over back to you, Madam Chair, to call the Lindsay family. Thank you.
Thank you. A bunch of people with Lindsay is a surname signed up, so any Lindsay who wants to come up, come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Shelley Lindsay from Ashland, and I'd like to introduce my family, please. This is my husband, Philip, my son, Simon, my daughter, Adeline, my son, Elliot, my son, Garrett, my son, Gideon, my daughter, Ivy, and my son, Ezekiel. In case you hadn't noticed, we're sort of a unique family. Philip and I were high school sweethearts and married at the age of 18. And on the day we married, we promised each other that we would never live a boring life, and we have not. We decided to get married young, have our children young, and then do something exciting with our lives. We very speedily had three wonderful sons, Matthew, Benjamin, and Noah, who are now all successful young men in their late 20s and 30s. And we also traveled to South Korea and adopted two beautiful, lovely young ladies who we adopted in infancy, our precious Kiki and Tess, who are now in their young 20s. We live in Ashland in a large home in the historical district. It's a very safe, beautiful place to live. Philip is a general contractor, and I am a child advocate. When we learned that over 400,000 children were waiting for adoption in the United States, most of color and most with special needs, we believed that our fate had been sealed and that we had our life set out for us. We chose to open our family and our home to these children. And that is the way that these children all became Lindsays that are with us today.
Mrs. Lindsay, if I can just break in for a second. We have your written testimony.
Yes, ma'am.
And there won't be time to read the whole thing.
No, so I won't be reading the whole thing.
Great. Thanks.
Our children came to us with a myriad of medical, physical, developmental, and emotional challenges and disabilities. And over the first few years that they were placed with us, that's what we attempted to do, is to learn to advocate for them and to access for them the resources that they needed to succeed in Ashland. They were very fortunate to be able to attend one of the top-ranked elementary schools in the whole state of Oregon, Briscoe Elementary School. In the spring of 1998, everything kind of collapsed around us. One afternoon, our son Isaac, who was 12 at the time, who is not with us today, came to us and very quietly told us that he had something bad he needed to tell us. Our hearts broke as he shared with us that he had been the victim of a sexual crime. And over the course of the next few hours, every one of the children that you see today came to us and shared that they had been raped and sodomized and horribly sexually humiliated and abused. Everything that we held sacred pretty much fell apart that day. The next year was pretty much just a blur for our family. It was filled with meetings with the district attorney, the police, the Children's Advocacy Center, as we struggled to keep our head above water and to keep going and loving our children and caring for them and supporting their older siblings while we all just reeled from this pain. When the children disclosed that they had been raped and sodomized, they identified their rapist as our next-door neighbor, a 14-year-old young man named Ryan Douglas Smith. It took almost a year to get to trial, but in February 1999, we went to trial with Judge Mark Shively in Jackson County. Every single day for 8 days, we walked these children up those marble steps, and we led them to the witness stand, and they testified for hours concerning their sexual abuse. They mentioned and discussed things that young children should never have to discuss, and our hearts broke as we listened to them. We had so much support from the district attorney's office, from the victim's advocate's office, from the Children's Advocacy Center. However, it was just barely enough to keep us putting one foot in front of the other. After 8 grueling days, of being hammered by three attorneys and our children respectfully answering, telling the truth, telling their stories, explaining in graphic detail how they had been abused, Judge Shively announced that he was ready to read his verdict. The verdict was, make sure I read this correctly. Ryan Smith was guilty of 5 counts of sexual abuse 1, 4 counts of sodomy 1, and 2 counts of rape 1. We gently led these children out of that courtroom that day, and we made them a solemn promise that they would never, ever have to speak about these horrible experiences in public, and we would do everything we could to heal them and protect them. 1 month later, my husband and I returned to court for Mr. Smith's sentencing. Our district attorney, Karen Loomis, argued vehemently that Mr. Smith should be placed in the Oregon Youth Authority to prevent any other children from being harmed. However, Judge Shively decided to give Mr. Smith one more chance and sentenced him to 8 days served in juvenile detention, probation, and community-based treatment. We felt that day that we had been kicked in the stomach because we felt, how could our children suffer so greatly and this man still be allowed back out on the streets? Our children did not feel safe at that point. Luckily, we didn't have to wait too long. Mr. Smith did not work with his treatment team, and he was in full denial of his crimes. He also failed his polygraphs. And 3 weeks later, Judge Shively ordered him remanded to the Oregon Youth Authority, where he remains today. It didn't surprise us that the Smith family mounted an appeal. The process took almost 3 years, and we were greatly relieved to receive a 20-page decision from Judges Edmonds, Armstrong, and Kistler, unanimously affirming the convictions and even commending the attorneys on a fine job on a difficult case. We learned after the fact that the Oregon Supreme Court had affirmed without opinion. In late 2004, we learned that Mr. Smith was mounting a post-conviction relief attempt. Our Assistant Attorney General, Susan Gerber, called us to reassure us that we really had nothing to worry about. Both the appeals court and the Supreme Court had upheld the convictions. No errors in the trial had been found. She assured us we really needed to not be concerned. We breathed a sigh of relief because we had far better things to do. We were very naive. Things turned ugly very, very quickly. We learned that the Attorney General's office represents the veracity of the original case, not our children, not the victims. This was, after all, a civil action brought by Mr. Smith against his attorneys alleging that they had failed to represent him adequately during trial. We were shocked beyond all reason when a process server arrived on our front porch and served our children with subpoenas. They were being ordered to testify for Ryan Smith, their rapist. The next day, we had another shock. We were served with a subpoena requiring that we turn over 15 years of all of our personal family records pertaining to our children's medical, emotional, educational, financial, and legal histories. We were shocked. Where had our victims' rights gone? The Attorney General's office recommended that we quickly hire a private attorney to have the subpoenas quashed. It was recommended also that we contact an organization called Crime Victims United, and that's how we met Steve Dole. He has stood by our family steadfastly through this entire 3-year experience. Mr. Dole also seemed very surprised by how our family was attacked through this lack of protection in the law. Our children had done absolutely everything asked of them by the police, the district attorney, and the judge. They'd made their disclosures. They had endured physical examinations. They'd been videotaped. They had undergone countless therapy sessions. They had testified truthfully. And then they tried to put their lives back together and be children. 7 years of healing had taken place. Now Mr. Smith's new attorneys were requiring them to be deposed and to turn over all their personal records of the last 15 years up to the present day. This seemed like another nightmare. First and foremost, I'm a mother, and a mother always protects her children. But I was powerless. Ms. Gerber and our personal attorney told us that in spite of all their motions and work to protect the children from deposition by hostile attorneys, it seemed unpreventable given the way the Oregon law presently read. The new judge had no cause to stop the depositions. I've never had a traffic ticket, and I have always found myself to be, or attempted to be, a good example for my children. But that summer of 2005, I made a startling decision. I decided to stand in contempt of court, to defy the court and to deny the subpoena's orders. I decided I would best serve my children by agreeing to be jailed to protect them. There was no way that I was going to allow Mr. Smith or his attorneys rip open the wounds that had just barely healed. We had had 7 years to work with them on their healing, and now they were at the cusp of adulthood, and we didn't have the luxury of seven more. Never in my whole life could I have ever imagined being in contempt of any court. Throughout 2005 and 2006, our family's focus once again became Ryan Smith. Every day was filled with court appearances, hearings, subpoenas, subpoena after subpoena. We had stacks this high. Once again, time was stolen from our family. We couldn't attend to school dances, soccer matches, our grandbabies being born. We couldn't have joy at weddings. We couldn't have joy at graduations because we had to appear in court. We had to discuss the sexual abuse, the rape, and the sodomies again and again and again. The children developed behavior problems, school problems, sleep problems, and health problems. And one of our children attempted suicide. How many times during those 2 years did one of these children utter to me, "This is not fair"? How many times did one of us cry out of just sheer frustration? We called in all the supports. Susan Gerber explained every step of the way to us. We talked with our district attorney at length. She worked with our children. Everyone involved seemed truly shocked and dismayed that we had no protection from this onslaught. This was the year of Katrina, and my husband decided to close his business and take the children to help the people who were suffering in the South. They left with a convoy of trucks, trailers, a motorhome, tractors, a crane, $40,000 worth of donated emergency supplies from Ashland, and six Lindsay children. Our group landed in Biloxi. Yes, ma'am.
Can you kind of get to the post-conviction part of this? Thank you.
While the children were in Biloxi, the judge ordered them returned to the state immediately, or we would be sanctioned further. When we appeared in court before that judge, we were warned that I would not be jailed for contempt of court. Rather, we would be fined or sanctioned thousands of dollars every day, which we did not provide our children for deposition. We were backed into a corner, and we had no choice. Philip took our two oldest daughters for their deposition. The deposition was held at Mr. Smith's attorney's office. We were assured that Mr. Smith would not be present. And yet when our daughter Tess walked into the room, she confronted her sibling's rapist, and he smirked at her. The attorneys actually discussed placing a potted plant in front of Mr. Smith so that our daughter did not have to watch him while she was deposed. It was that day that we made the determination that no other Lindsay child would confront Mr. Smith at a deposition. We negotiated daily with the attorneys, and we finally worked out an agreement that our children would be deposed at the Jackson County Children's Advocacy Center with me present and with a therapist present to support the children. Each of these children had to be deposed for 1 to 3 hours each. I was deposed for 7 hours. There was one point in the deposition where Mr. Smith's attorney looked at one of my daughters and said, "This is a little difficult for you, isn't it, honey?" It took our breath away just how much cruelty there was. No one in that room seemed to grasp the trauma that these children had gone through. We felt that we had lost the battle, but we had come through strong again. The next month, we were notified that our doctors, our schools, and the Children's Services Department was served with subpoenas asking for all of our records for 15 years. Our attorneys were able to get a writ of mandamus from the Supreme Court, barring this information going to the attorneys. However, before that writ was served, 3,000 pieces of documents ended up in Mr. Smith's attorney's offices, which they have to this day. In November 2006, 2 days before Thanksgiving, 10 days after the birth of a new grandson, Ryan Smith's post-conviction trial was held before Judge Pat Wilkie of Josephine County. Our entire family attended, as most of us were subpoenaed. The children bravely entered the courtroom and faced the man who had raped them when they were little children. The children were, at the time of their rapes, Garrett was 7, Elliot was 8, Simon was 9, Adeline, Ivy, Zeke, and Garrett were 10, and Isaac was 12. Once again, it was the children's strength that brought us through. Ms. Gerber impressed us greatly with her knowledge of our case and the law. We resolved that day to make certain that no other victim should ever have to endure what our family had gone through for the past 3 years. 2 months after the trial, this year, we learned that Judge Wilkie had found no cause to set aside the convictions. The post-conviction relief was denied. Ryan Smith would stay in the Oregon Youth Authority until he was 25 years old. He had exhausted all avenues. He was guilty of raping our children. This is our family's story. We ask that this committee consider it carefully. Victims deserve protection. Many of those protections are already in existence in this state and are used daily. Victims do not want to face the person who harmed them. Victims require time to heal. Victims do not want to be forced over and over and over again to testify about their pain and trauma. Victims and their families want to move on with their lives. We ask that you assure them this protection. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you all you kids for coming up here and bearing witness to this testimony.
Well, my son Simon has a short statement, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Simon. Can you give your name for the record?
Yes. My name is Simon Lindsay, and I go to Ashland High School. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Simon Lindsay, and I am a sophomore at Ashland High School. I am 17 years old, and I was adopted when I was 2. I play varsity soccer, and I am a pretty good student. I have 12 brothers and sisters, 8 dogs, and 2 cats. When I was 9 years old and in the second grade, I was raped by our next-door neighbor, a 14-year-old boy named Ryan Smith. He raped me on 2 different days in the Briscoe bathroom. I was a really little kid, and he seemed huge. He told me he was my friend and that it wouldn't hurt. He was at our school visiting his mom, our librarian. He told me that if I told anyone, he would kill me. I can't tell you how bad the rapes hurt. I'll never forget that day until I die. Our family had to go to court and testify to what Ryan did. It was terrible to have to get up and talk about such personal stuff when you're a little kid. It was horrible to see all my brothers and sisters and parents hurting too. I was very glad when Ryan was found guilty and sent to OIA. Three of his convictions were because of me. I thought I'd never have to see him again. I'm here today to ask you to make laws to keep victims from having to testify over and over again. When I found out that I had to be deposed and tell my story again, I started to have nightmares that wouldn't go away. I also had to think sometimes that Ryan was following me. I couldn't forget that he told me he'd kill me or hurt my sisters if I told. It's not easy being a teenager and trying to do well in sports and in school and then have friends, also worrying about some crazy person who hurt you a long time ago. So please, change the law so no one else has to do what I had to do. Thank you very much.
And thank you for coming, Simon. We really appreciate it. Are there questions? Committee? Thank you. Mr. Lindsay, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's very powerful testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Josh Marquis and Susan Gerber. I would ask that you be very brief.
I'll be very brief. I don't know how to speak long. My name is Josh Marquis. I'm District Attorney of Clatsop County, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Our organization, and I would strongly urge you to pass this bill. When Mrs. Lindsay called me a couple years ago, I thought it was a horror story. I did not even know that this was possible, and I've been a prosecutor for 23 years. But worse, I found out that her story, although one of the worst, is not alone. So this is something that really needs fixing. Ms. Gerber can, I think, address that better than I.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Gerber. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I represented the state in the case involving the Lindsay family. I also have about 108 pending post-conviction cases currently. There's six attorneys in our office who handle post-conviction matters. What I can say for certain is this is not an isolated matter. This happens in many different cases where victims are subpoenaed for depositions and or testimony at hearings in post-conviction matters. And if Councillor Taylor, I can address your question regarding the definition of victims. Our idea behind that was basically the victims named in the indictment. Specifically in this case, all the children were named victims in the indictment that the petitioner was convicted of, and that's the idea behind it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any other questions? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 985. Open work session on Senate Bill 985. Senator Byers.
Madam Chair, can you raise this bill?
Ready to move the bill.
Move Senate Bill 985 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers has moved Senate Bill 985 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank the folks for coming and testifying. It was must have been difficult to do. It's difficult to live those moments in your life. And I just appreciate that they've made the effort to try to make it so someone else doesn't have to go through that second part of being re-victimized.
We don't always move a bill on the same day that we hear it, but I wanted you to see this one move on its way. So that you can know that as you travel back down the freeway. So ordered. I'm going to give Senator Bates an opportunity to carry this bill. He's your senator that you visited with, and if he does not do that, I will carry this bill. Okay, now we will open a public hearing, and thank you again for coming.
Yes, thank you very much.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 950. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 950 comes to you from Senator Burdick and Senator Varkian. It exempts from disclosure the public electronic mail addresses of patrons of public libraries when it is together with the address and telephone number of the patron. You have a dash one amendments in front of you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that basically is exempts from disclosure to the public electronic mail address of the patron, regardless of whether it's connected with the other material or not.
Hey, Jan Hine. To hear this bill today so that you wouldn't have to change the date on your testimony again. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Library Association, in support of Senate Bill 950 to exempt library patrons' email addresses from disclosure under the public records law. The issue that this bill addresses came to our attention last year when a judge in Florida ruled that a public library must disclose its email addresses to a commercial entity, its patrons' email addresses, to a commercial entity that had asked for them. At that time, I thought perhaps existing law would protect email addresses. The state librarian asked for an informal opinion from the Attorney General's office, and that opinion came back essentially saying probably not. Current law does not protect them. Since most public libraries in the state now routinely obtain their patrons' email addresses, we thought that this bill was an important protection. The Dash 1 amendments are address that because the bill was introduced in such a way that the email addresses would be protected only together with the names, and the Dash 1 amendments make it clear that they would be protected on their own without the names. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and we urge your support.
So thank just you. To clarify, the Dash 1 amendment makes the protects the email address regardless of whether it's associated with a name.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
In many cases, as we know, email addresses are very similar to names. Okay. Any questions from the committee?
I have one.
Senator Walker.
Does this keep the federal government's mitts off email addresses of people who check out books in the library?
Patriot Act question.
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, that's a good question. Circulation records are already protected. I don't know the answer, frankly.
Well, Madam Chair, I would assume the federal government can find our email addresses anyhow, but I see Andrea Meyer waiting in the wings from ACLU to answer that. I just don't want the federal government to have access to this information.
It moves in the right direction, certainly. Andrea, did you want to say something?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. It would be our impression that this would have no effect whatsoever in the government's ability not only to get a court order to get these, but to use a national security letter, as they have used in the past, which is simply a letter from the head of the FBI of that division, obtaining records such that the person never knows. So this goes to one issue, but certainly does not, and I don't know that there's any way we can get to that in the state of Oregon.
Well, you just have to buy books now, Madam Chair,
right,
instead of buying them in a library.
But your book records.
Under this very broad authority, they already have access to records that are already confidential. Isn't that correct?
Chair Burdick, yes, if you're using the term confidential in terms of the public records exemptions or other such records which might not be readily available to anyone in the public, that is correct.
Okay. One of those things.
Oh, well, it's the world we live in, unfortunately.
For the record, we do support this particular bill, as it's important to balance both the privacy interests of the individuals as well as, you know, our public records. So we often look at both aspects of this, and in this case, we come down over the privacy interests of the individual patrons.
So disclosure is very important, but we have a pretty strong precedent in other areas of protecting email addresses in higher ed and other areas. So did you have anything to add, Ms. Hine?
Madam Chair, no, I don't. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't have anyone else signed up. Is anybody else who wants to talk? Okay, close the hearing on Senate Bill 950. Senator Beyer, would you be comfortable? Okay, open the work session on Senate Bill 950. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments in the Senate Bill 950.
Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 1 amendments
to Senate Bill 950. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 950 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 950 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, I'll carry this one. All right, now our last bill of the day. We'll see how far we can get. Senate Bill 1008, open a public hearing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1008 comes to the Committee on Judiciary at the request of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Madam Chair, members of the committee, requires the court to hold a hearing for a person charged with a crime other than a felony or a Class A misdemeanor involving violence against a person or a crime of the driving under the influence to determine if the interests of justice would best serve by allowing the defendant into a substance abuse diversion agreement.
Okay, Ann Christian.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I'm a legislative representative for Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. We have over 1,000 attorneys in the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 1008 is one of OCDLA's highest priorities for this legislative session. In a nutshell, what it does is it restores some of the discretion that our circuit court judges have had taken away from them over the course of time. Let me give you a little context. I provided written testimony to you, and what I frequently find helpful when I'm looking at some new idea is to look at what do we currently have that's similar to Senate Bill 1008. What do we currently have available in the state of Oregon? The concept is we have many, as we heard on the from the testimony on the first bill this afternoon, many individuals who are repeat property offenders. That's the primary focus of this bill, who have substance abuse problems. And in the state of Oregon, if you'll turn to the last two pages of the written testimony, I prepared a table that attempts in a simple manner to compare what we currently have available in the state of Oregon, short of the regular, the traditional criminal justice system, to deal with individuals who have substance abuse problems. And we have currently three diversion programs. Diversion programs are geared toward giving an individual who is facing criminal charges an alternative to the traditional criminal justice system. Criminal justice system traditionally is one where a defendant enters a plea of not guilty, can either go to trial, negotiate with the district attorney. If that person is convicted, they wind up on probation or going to prison, and that's the traditional approach. A diversion program, which one of them, which is the first one listed on the table, a DA diversion, has been around for decades. It's a program where the district attorney looks at the individual, the defendant, assesses a variety of factors that I've listed in this table. For example, is it a first-time offender? That becomes part of the equation. Will the defendant benefit from some kind of treatment? Generally, it's substance abuse treatment, but there are also other conditions of a diversion agreement, such as community service. A key one is restitution to the victim. So there are a number of factors that the district attorney in this decades-long diversion program looks at toward the end of deciding, and it's the district attorney who decides whether this individual standing before the DA today will be allowed to do an alternative program. So what our bill, Senate Bill 1008, when we put in the request to legislative council, we said mirror the district attorney's diversion statute with two exceptions. The first exception is the judge is the one who decides whether or not an individual, if it were me, gets to go to substance abuse program in return for a dismissal of my case if I successfully complete the program, pay restitution, whatever else the judge orders. So the first difference between a DA diversion and our bill, Senate Bill 1008, is that the judge is the ultimate decider of whether I get the opportunity of this treatment. And the second of only two differences is that Senate Bill 1008 does not have a restriction, such as the DA's diversion, that a person can only avail themselves, a criminal defendant can only go through diversion once. I think our drug court, our experience with drug courts in the state of Oregon make clear that an individual who has a substance abuse addiction is going to fail many times before they successfully, and they never successfully beat the addiction. I'm struggling for the correct term. But through the course of treatment, there will be times when they have bad UAs, have relapses. Our notion is, our being Oregon criminal defense lawyers, is that judges ultimately should make this decision, and people deserve a second chance. If they've gone through a diversion before and failed, and they're a repeat property offender, based upon what we continuously hear, and we heard on the first bill this afternoon, we need to get our arms around the recidivism issue, especially with property offenses. So Senate Bill 1008 mirrors the DUII diversion statute. I've been speaking with a representative from the Oregon Judicial Department. They have some practical concerns about some aspects of the bill with regard to the hearing. When committee counsel summarized the bill to you, it was indicated that the court would have to hold a hearing on every individual who faces an accusatory instrument where there's some indication that, if it were me, I have some substance abuse issue. We had asked the bill to be drafted so that it was clear that not every single case would require a hearing. The bill is drafted to say that the defense has to file a motion. The idea was that individuals who clearly, number one, were not ready for treatment, meaning they had not hit rock bottom and decided that they need to get treatment, that those individuals would not be petitioning the court. And our second notion was that in my discussions with the Judicial Department, we've been talking about some manner in which to attach, if you will, to a petition that a defendant has to submit some evidence, some objective evidence, not simply me as a criminal defendant saying, gee, I'd like to do treatment because I don't want to go to prison. Some objective evidence that I am at a point where I will succeed or at least give a good try at treatment. And I understand that there are such instruments available that are addiction severity screening, and that could be, and that's what I've been talking to the Judicial Department about. I heard that earlier this afternoon that Oregon is number four in the nation with respect to property crime, and the bill as drafted would cover any type of criminal offense other than DUII or what's called, quote, a person crime, because we clearly did not want to include what we saw as violent felony types of offenses within this diversion program. And I believe Mr. Neely from the District Attorney's Office will bring to your attention that property crimes also include like an arson three. I'm not an expert on sentencing guidelines or this type of thing, but arson three, and I can tell you that was clearly not our intent. We primarily want to focus on drug offenses and on property offenses. So with that, I would thank you, Chair Burdick, for giving us a hearing on what we think is a really important bill, because as Mr. Marquis told you earlier, and I don't know the statistic, but he indicated that 84% of criminal defendants don't go to prison. Our point under this bill is that if an individual has a substance abuse addiction, and a district attorney, because the district attorney programs, as far as I understand, differ county by county, and that's fine, but if an individual does not qualify under a district attorney diversion, we see Senate Bill 1008 as simply saying, let a judge decide whether or not this person can be given treatment, with a carrot out there that their case will be dismissed if they succeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, a couple, Madam Chair. First off, How does this differ from drug court? I mean, are these different categories of crime?
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, that was one of my first questions, is don't we have drug court to cover this problem, and drug courts are wonderful. To my knowledge, and there may be an exception, but to my knowledge, drug courts deal with possession of controlled substance offenses, and we're trying to widen that net to include property offenses.
Okay, a comment and then an additional question. The follow-up being, I think that one of the compelling reasons drug court works is that if you fail drug court, you go to prison. And so I think that's, if you're talking about a carrot, I would think there would need to be a stick as well. But the other question you talked about...
Wait, before you leave that point, I think there's...
And Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, any diversion has both the carrot and the stick. So if I fail to do as I'm told to, whether I'm in drug court or whether I'm before the court on a DA diversion or this bill, I'm facing serious consequences if I don't. But I also have the carrot out there hopefully spurring me along.
It requires a guilty plea or a no-contest plea before you go into diversion. So if you fail diversion, then you've got the full force of whatever the sentence is.
Madam Chair, thank you for making that clear, because that's a critical part that I know the Oregon District Attorney's Association feels very strongly about. And, in fact, I believe it was two sessions ago that the DA's Association was able to get that changed so that people have to plead guilty to get into DUII diversion.
Additional follow-up, and I guess I would be interested, 20 years ago when I had greater familiarity with this sort of thing, diversion was considered somewhat of a joke because it was easy to game the system. But if indeed since then they have come up with instruments that a person can fill out a form and somebody can determine when they've hit rock bottom and are truly ready for treatment, I would love to see that, because I don't think such an instrument exists.
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I'm certainly not the expert in this room. And I just know that it's called an addiction severity screening instrument. And I don't know. I'm sure there have been improvements in 20 years.
Okay, Madam Chair. Determining the level of severity of addiction is one thing. Determining when a person's willing to quit playing games is an entirely different matter. And there's nobody better at playing games than addicts.
And, Madam Chair, I would agree, having represented many.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Karen Wheeler and Josh, why don't you come on up too? Welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services. And thank you for allowing me to testify on Senate Bill 1008 today. The division is neutral on this bill since this is not in the governor's budget. The Addictions and Mental Health Division would be responsible for establishing a substance abuse diversion treatment program, managing resources, and administering funds generated by this bill. Since this program's not been around in Oregon, it's difficult to determine the amount of clients or new programs that this bill would create. Diverting nonviolent drug offenders to substance abuse treatment is an effective approach. Other states, and I won't say Washington today, but California, passed a law in 2000 called the California Substance Abuse and Crime Prevention Act to divert all nonviolent drug offenders from jail to drug abuse treatment. Research that's fairly new, just conducted by the University of California, Los Angeles, documented a substantial cost benefit ranging from $2 to $4 for every dollar invested in this program. And I would echo one of the concerns that this bill does not address is the drug court language. As you know, Oregon has provided a lot of leadership around drug court development, and drug courts rely on close judicial monitoring, coordination among judicial and treatment professionals, random and frequent drug testing, as well as other operational features, and that's why they're successful. We would welcome the opportunity to implement Senate Bill 1008 in accordance with accepted drug court standards. And I thank you for allowing me to testify. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So in your opinion, would it work just as well just to open up the scope of drug courts to be able to include property crime?
Madam Chair, I do think that would be a good idea.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you. Josh.
My name is Josh Markey. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal, the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I was a criminal defense attorney for 2 years, and I remember that I would, sometimes we're ambiguous. I won't be ambiguous. We think this is really bad legislation. And I'm sorry Senator Walker is gone. She made the point that, I wasn't here on behalf of the Criminal Justice Commission. This has nothing to do with the Criminal Justice Commission. The Oregon DA's Association is well represented by Kevin Neely. But sometimes we think bills are really good or really bad idea, and we ask for an elected district attorney, like myself, to get up at 5 in the morning and drive 280 miles round trip to discuss a bill. This is one of those bills. And Ms. Christian has tried to imply that we'd somehow be restoring what we once had. There has never been a situation in the state of Oregon where judges got to decide people going into diversion on charges like conspiracy to commit murder, delivery of methamphetamine to a minor, paramilitary activity, aggravated animal abuse, criminal non-support, felon in possession of firearms, hindering prosecution, and I can go on and on and on. What the OCDLA has done here is taken a system that has worked fairly well for DUIs and blown the doors off it and said, we're going to put everybody except person criminals in that. And we're going to take away she said it was just a small change. It'd be like saying, well, we'll just change the burden of proof a little bit. We'll just switch it to the defendant from the prosecution. We have a system of checks and balances in our government, and part of it is that the district attorneys, who are elected by the people in every county, make charging decisions. This would change that and basically say, no, we're going to have judges make those decisions in all these kinds of cases. And as a former criminal defense attorney, albeit only for 18 months, I can tell you that I would expect for there to be petitions in every single case in which somebody had even a colorable issue of addiction. And I can tell you, as someone who's practiced law for 25 years, that, and I think probably Ms. Christian and most people would agree with me who practice criminal law, probably something like 75% of the people who are in the justice system have a substance abuse problem. Not much question about that. Now, drug courts work in the state because district attorneys have agreed, as in my county, to basically turn over the management of those cases to judges. And judges and probation officers will work on them one-on-one. And Senator Cruz, one of the reasons we do that, to be blunt, is you can't go to prison in Oregon for drugs. There's no way a judge can send you to prison for simple possession, even under departure sentence. Simply can't happen. It's one of the great myths of Oregon is that we send people to prison for using drugs. I'm not in favor of sending somebody to prison for using drugs, but this bill goes so far beyond that. It basically creates a structure unlike anything I've ever heard of before. And with all due respect to the other witness, I'm also vice president of the National DA's Association, and I've had a chance to speak to people from the California DA's Association. And generally speaking, Measure 36, which is I think what she's referring to, has been considered something of a disaster down there because it's granted not second bites of the apple, but fourth, fifth, sixth. It's taken away from judges the ability. So to say that this would restore the ability of judges to make these decisions is really misleading because judges never had that function in the first place. We have a gatekeeper form of government in which the prosecutor makes a decision about whether the person should be charged. And under this bill, we'd have a right to object, similar as we would in DUII diversion. But it would be Katie bar the door. This would be a dramatic change in the justice system in Oregon.
Josh, let me ask you the same question I asked Ms. Wheeler, and that is if you could expand the scope of drug court to deal with not those other crimes you mentioned. I don't think anybody intended those, but people who are just constant, repeat property offenders where clearly the meth addiction or some drug addiction is driving their repeat property offender behavior. Would you favor something to expand drug courts to where they could admit those people?
You can do that under current law, and many district attorneys do.
There are people who can be in drug court for unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, people who can be in drug court for theft in the first degree. It's not confined simply to possession. Each different counties have different rules. My county's fairly is I allow cases that probably Multnomah County would never allow. We even allow, in our county, addict dealers, low-level dealers, into drug court. But that's a decision that has to be made on a case-by-case basis by district attorneys. This takes all of that away and basically says we're going to just let the defense attorney apply, and it doesn't matter what the offense is. And with all due respect, Chair, this does say any other than a crime, other than a person crime or driving under the influence. So it does just blow the doors off the definitions.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you.